This is Vermont Edition. I'm Jane Lindholm. We are heading into a holiday weekend that's all about food, American history, and traveling to be with family and friends. And those are some of the themes we're plunging into today on Vermont Edition. We start, of course, with the meal. Rebecca Roop is an award-winning author and food historian based in Vermont. She's written more than 20 books, including How Carrots Won the Trojan War. This month, she has an online article for National Geographic Food called Eat, Drink, and Be Merry. It examines the cultural significance of food and the power of food to bring people together. Rebecca Roop, welcome to Vermont Edition.
Well, thank you so much. It's always fun to be here.
You say that humans are unique in the animal kingdom for how we've placed food on a pedestal, not just as sustenance, but as something that is a way to bond and to create culture. Why do you think that is?
Actually, I think food is fascinating in the way it is social glue for us. You know, we feed our pets in the morning, and they will eat side by side out of the same bowl. But you don't get any of this eye-to-eye contact and chat like you get with people sitting around a dinner table. We're the only species that seems to have this communal, cultural, social relationship to our meals. And I find that fascinating. Where did that come from? And you know, clearly, evolutionarily, it started early. We have hearths that date back hundreds of thousands, if not, you know, pushing 2 million years old, where clearly people were sitting around sharing food.
How do you think this has helped to develop human society? Is it significant to how we've developed?
I think so. You know, some anthropologists guess that everything we are may have come out of our habit of sitting down together at dinner, kinship systems, ethics, sense of right and wrong. You came home and you divided up the food. There must have been, you know, some social jockeying to that. Technology, passing around ideas at the hearth side.
When you look these days at studies, you cite ones that show that children get better grades, they have better vocabularies, teenagers are more likely to like their parents when they live in families where there are shared meals. And you take pains to point out that, of course, there are other factors at play here. So you can't just cite that this is just down to sharing meals. But in families where shared meals are a part of the ritual, children seem to fare better and adults are healthier.
Absolutely. Basically, people, you know, when you eat together, you tend to eat better. But there are a lot of social and psychological benefits to sitting down for a shared meal. And this isn't to say that you've got a wildly dysfunctional family, you're flinging plates at each other, and just because you sit down and share a chicken pot pie, it's not going to solve all the problems. But usually families that have the sorts of values and traditions that lead to home cooking and shared meals get a lot of benefits out of this kind of interaction. More communication. The kids learn better table manners. You bond. You get to know each other better. And so the idea of the family meal has a lot more going for it than just vitamins and minerals.
But you also cite that, what was it, one out of five Americans now eats at least one meal in the car?
Right.
And one out of four is eating a fast food meal every day?
Absolutely. You know, we've come a ways from the everybody around the table every night era of Leave It to Beaver. But still, about 30% of American families claim that they eat dinner together every single night. And I think it's something like 50% say they get at least four meals together a week. So we're still getting some bennies from family meals. We haven't completely fallen apart.
And, you know, you've studied all of this. Do you think that that's important? Because there are other things that go along with not being able to share meals. You know, if we're talking about families, to working parents who may not be able to get home in time to cook meals and have everybody sit at the table at the same time. But there might be socioeconomic benefits for that family that they wouldn't be getting if they were in a position to share meals every day. Or, you know, other reasons that people may have to have a meal in the car or have a fast food meal. Do you think that we're losing something if we're not having these shared home-cooked meals?
I think the shared home-cooked meals are wonderful, but there are zillions of other ways in which families become close to each other and communicate with each other. It doesn't have to be a meal. Maybe it's sitting around a bedtime story. family trips. But it's amazing how much of human social interaction has to do with food. You know, one of our first instincts, you're meeting somebody and it's, let's go for coffee. Let's go out for a drink. First date, let's go for dinner. So food seems to be a common denominator that connects a lot of things.
And not just those meeting people or social events. I mean, you talk about funerals have food rituals. Weddings have food rituals. Birthdays, think of birthday cake, obviously a food ritual there. Pretty much every symbolic moment in someone's life usually has some kind of food attached to it.
Definitely.
And that's not just an American thing.
No. This seems to be worldwide, though certainly customs vary astronomically from place to place. But there's still that common denominator of the shared meal.
I'm talking with Rebecca Roop. She's a food historian and an author, and we're talking about some food traditions and why food is such a big part of our culture. In this piece for National Geographic, you write a little bit about food can certainly be a status symbol. It can be a sign of wealth. And I've often been struck by how different things are in the United States these days, where there used to be this sense that if you could eat meat, rich meat, that was a sign of socioeconomic status, that you had some money. And of course, these days, perhaps local organic vegetables are more of a sign of status when you can get a very cheap hamburger from McDonald's for much cheaper. You think about these shifts in what conveys socioeconomic status when it comes to food.
Think of bread. You know, white bread used to be what you wanted to have on the upper class table. It showed that you were really wealthy. And now it's artisanal brown breads are the status symbol. And white sliced bread is the peanut butter and jelly sandwich of the lower socioeconomic groups.
Have you seen other shifts like that?
You know, so many these days with fresh garden vegetables. You know, certainly the idea was that if you bought your stuff from the store, you were wealthier than people who had to grab their potatoes out of the backyard. Now, your very own organic potatoes are a plus.
Mm-hmm. And are something that you sort of carry with you as a status symbol in a way.
Yes, look at my potatoes.
Let's talk a little bit about some of the meals of the past. I loved your description of what Romans used to serve for very extravagant banquets. If you don't mind, I'm going to read one of your lines here. You say, night-long banquets that began with jellyfish and stuffed sow's udders continued through roasted deer, boiled ostrich, dormice stuffed with pine nuts, and flamingo with dates, and ended with sweet wine cakes and fricassee of roses. Oh, I'd love to try that meal.
Fricassee of roses.
Isn't that? I can't even picture that, to be totally honest. And I don't know what dormice is. Am I even saying that right?
Dormice? You know, little rodent-like animals.
Oh, they are mice.
Yeah. I think they're like guinea pigs.
Wow.
I'm displaying my ignorance, too.
I mean, it sounds like
I know they had one in Alice in Wonderland that kept falling asleep.
Yes, the dormouse.
Right.
And I always thought that was D-O-O-R.
It looks like a little guinea pigish creature.
Oh, got it. Okay. Well, it sounds like a wonderful meal. I mean, just that extravagance, flamingo with dates.
Yum.
You think so?
No, I don't, actually. Flamingo doesn't appeal to me. Though certainly in the past, all kinds of birds were eaten that we no longer have on the table. Heron, crane, pigeon. A lot of small songbirds, thrushes, and larks.
Mm. And in some countries, you can still eat those. You know, France has a tradition of eating small songbirds, and you eat them bone and all, right, under a little sheet so nobody can watch you?
Yes, crunching.
Yes. So why do you think it's important to know about some of those past traditions, given that we don't eat dormice, that we don't tend to eat flamingo anymore? Is it helpful at all to have a sense of the past when we look to what our food traditions are today?
Actually, I personally find it fascinating just to see the progression through time of how eating has changed and how table manners have changed and how the way we approach food has changed, especially when you think about how formal dinners used to be. For example, in the medieval period, eating was completely hierarchical. You know, where you sat was almost equivalent to sitting in alphabetical order in a classroom today, except by rank. And on medieval tables, there was a salt that was planked in the middle of the table, which wasn't a small salt cellar. Often these were massive aquarium-sized things with gold, jewels, sculptures, and a little bowl for salt. And anyone who was above the salt was in, and anyone who was below the salt was servant class and out.
But yet they were all eating together, but so the servant class was still at the same table?
They were all at the same table.
Which is a very different scene than what viewers of Downton Abbey will know from the, you know, above and below, the upstairs, downstairs
stairs
kind of thing. And then that whole idea of dressing for dinner, that you had to be dressed to the nines just to go have your evening meal.
Absolutely. And of course, that was very hierarchical, too, because it was still who sat where at the table, who went into dinner first. And there was a lot of jockeying for position certainly in the Victorian era.
Even within that upper crust.
Yeah.
What do you think about as you prepare for Thanksgiving?
I think, oh, good heavens, I hope nothing goes wrong this year. There's always a catastrophe.
What do you cook?
You know, we're fairly modern traditional. We do turkey and dressing, mashed potatoes.
How similar is that to the original first Thanksgiving?
Not particularly. I think if we were all doing a traditional first Thanksgiving, we'd be dining on venison and cornmeal mush.
Mm.
There isn't a whole lot that's written about what was eaten at the first Thanksgiving. There's a record that says that some men went out fowling a couple of days before the feast, but not what they brought back. So it was probably ducks, geese, swans, probably passenger pigeons. In the 1620s, the passenger pigeons were still thick in the air. Maybe some wild turkeys, but they didn't make a big deal of it.
Yeah, turkey was not the centerpiece.
No. And cranberries probably were not very high on anybody's list. Certainly the Wampanoags, the Indians, had them. And usually they served them up in pemmican, which would have been dried venison, fat, and pounded cranberries. And cranberries, all on their lonesome, as we all know, are pretty tongue-curdling, sour, unpleasant berries.
Mm-hmm.
So the pilgrims probably didn't really enjoy cranberries for another 20 years until they got a source of sugar and honey.
You also write that probably some shellfish was involved, lobsters, perhaps mussels, which we don't tend to see on typical Thanksgiving plates these days.
No, we don't, and never eels. I have never been to a Thanksgiving dinner that served eels.
Are there different Thanksgiving food traditions in different parts of the country that you know about? I mean, certainly turkey and mashed potatoes, as you said, sort of modern traditional. But are there other regions of the country that add something to that plate?
I think there are many different Thanksgiving traditions. I know there's a sauerkraut tradition in Pennsylvania, which I learned from my husband. And being from Vermont, I'm like, sauerkraut, really?
New Year's is another one that has a lot of food traditions associated with either your ethnic heritage or your regional heritage, whether you're having black-eyed peas, whether you're having something else that might connote good luck for the coming year.
Soba noodles. Soba noodles are the thing in Japan because they're long. You're thinking longevity and good fortune.
You mentioned earlier that people are still making an effort to have some family meals together. You started your article by saying this is a feature that is unique to humans. It's a part of human evolution and it's a part of human culture. Is it going to go away ever?
I would say no. I cannot imagine that we will ever, even if it's available to us, be happy with the gulp one capsule and it's a meal, like in Buck Rogers in the 21st century. You know, that's just not us. For us, food is communication, it's friendship, it's connection. And I think we need that. And I think we'll always appreciate that.
Rebecca Roop is a Vermont author and a food historian whose latest article for National Geographic explores how food has brought people together over time. We have a link to the article called Eat, Drink, and Be Merry at vpr.net. Rebecca, thanks very much for talking with us.
Oh, thank you so much. This was delightful.
And happy Thanksgiving.
Happy Thanksgiving to you, too.
Coming up next on Vermont Edition, Vermont novelist Tim Weed takes us back in time to the colonial era for his novel Will Poole's Island. It's an exploration of Native American culture and history and a challenge to some pervasive myths and gaps in knowledge about that era. That's just ahead on Vermont Edition. I'm Jane Lindholm. Welcome back to Vermont Edition. During our fall book show recently, we heard from many of you about wonderful local authors whose novels are on your reading lists. One Vermont writer who was recommended by a few listeners is Tim Weed. Weed's new novel is a perfect fit for the Thanksgiving season. It's called Will Poole's Island. It's historical fiction set in the colonial era, and it tells the story of an English boy who becomes immersed in a Native community. VPR's Peter Biello talked with Weed about the inspiration behind the story and about the author's interest in bringing accuracy to our understanding of how English and Native cultures collided.
So Will Poole is an English teenager from a wealthy family, and his parents have died, and he's under the care of a guardian whom he despises. And in your novel, he feels oppressed by the strict Puritan society. How would you describe Will Poole's life at the beginning of the novel?
Well, I think you're right. He's in many ways, he's what we would consider to be a typical teenager, in that he feels claustrophobic. He feels the need to get out and get away. But on top of that is the fact that he's existing in a historical period when oppression or repression he feels in his community is particularly acute. One of the things that was interesting in my research for the book was accounts of young English men and women who were kidnapped by different indigenous groups. And when it came time to be ransomed or rescued, they were often reluctant to return to these English communities because they found a sort of freedom and ease in the indigenous communities that they didn't find in English society.
They were less oppressive than the Puritan society.
Yeah, a lot freer, the ability to be yourself a little bit more.
And while he's out with Squamiset, he learns a variety of hunting and survival techniques, as well as some, I guess you would call them, mystical skills. Could you tell us a little bit about those?
Yeah. One of the things, another thing that was fascinating to me in my research was this idea that both the English and the Indian societies at the time were very much, their worldviews included a lot of what I would call the visionary and the unseen. And so in terms of researching the book, I did a lot of research on shamanism in particular. And so Squamiset is a shaman, or what the Wampanoags, or the Native Americans at that time, would have called a powwow. And so Will, it turns out, has a proclivity for these things. And so that's one of the skills that he learns from Squamiset.
What inspired you to write this story?
Well, you know, it started out, I was doing a lot of family research. I was tracing my English ancestors back to the 1630s. And I started to learn about some very interesting stories. There was the story of Thomas Trowbridge, who came over to New Haven, Connecticut, and became one of the founders of New Haven, Connecticut, with three young boys. And Thomas Trowbridge went back to England to fight for Oliver Cromwell in the English Civil War, and was promptly killed in battle, leaving his three sons as orphans in the care of a servant who turned out to be corrupt and basically swindled these boys out of their fortunes. And so that was a very provocative story for me. But at the same time, I have Native American ancestors, and that's a side that hasn't been well represented. There were no firsthand account of Native Americans before the 19th century. And so in a way, the motivation for the book was to sort of immerse myself in this period and to find out more about it, and if I could, to find out what I consider to be the truth about the period.
And in addition to your family connections giving some basis for this fictional account in reality, you also mentioned in your author's note that Squamiset was based on a real person.
Yes. In 1614, so this was 6 years before Plymouth Rock, an English sea captain named Thomas Hunt kidnapped 27 Algonquian-speaking Indians from different spots along the New England coast and brought them back to Malaga, Spain, and sold them into slavery. One of this group was a Patuxet Wampanoag Indian who called himself Tisquantum, which was a name that was later shortened to Squanto. And Tisquantum had a very interesting story. He managed to escape slavery in Spain. He made his way up to England, and he spent 5 years in London living in the household of an English nobleman who had interest in colonizing the New World. And so he became fluent in English and made his way back to the New World. And when he came back to New World, he was, you know, became one of the interpreters for the Wampanoags, or the Pilgrims, encountered when they landed at Plymouth Rock. So it's a very interesting story, and Squamiset is in a way based on this true story of Tisquantum.
The story is about, in my view, someone trying to just live more fully. You know, Will Poole feeling like there's got to be more to life than the walls of this settlement. The novel involves Will Poole's eventual search for safe haven from the colony, which he has renounced so that he can live with and learn from Squamiset. So the book seems to alternate between action scenes running from the English who are chasing him and contemplative scenes in which Will is reflecting on his place in his new society, his abilities, his relationship with the Indians. So how did you strike that balance between this sort of action and contemplative life?
Well, I think that's an interesting observation, and to me, that is something that literature can do in a way that no other medium can, including film, maybe even especially film, that this idea that literature exists on the knife edge between experience and consciousness. So I think that that's the balance any novelist needs to strike, because I think that that's the sort of comparative advantage of literature, is the ability to get inside someone's mind and allow the reader to experience life, you know, from the inside of a character as well as from the exterior.
So you mentioned it a few times, the fact that these characters who refuse to go back to the society they were born in, do you feel a certain kinship? Is that something you feel, that the rules surrounding you in this society are perhaps too tight?
Well, that's interesting. I don't know if I feel that way now. I do feel that I felt that way as a teenager. And I think that a lot of teenagers feel the same way. Maybe they don't articulate it that way.
Parental rules.
Parental rules and this sense of restriction, and you have to break out. I mean, I have two teenage children, so it's familiar. I mean, a lot of the feedback I've got on the book, I mean, I've gotten some great feedback, but some of the best has been from kids of that age, you know, teenagers who really seem to resonate with it. And also this idea of getting outside, that's some of the best thing I've heard. It's like, this book really made me want to be outside.
One of the persistent themes here in this book is that people can only see what they want to see, or they see what they fear, and that the conjurers like Squamiset are able to provide these illusions, evoke these images that can sort of paralyze people. Is that something you encountered in your research?
Yes. I mean, I think that some of that was in my research and some of that has been in my experience. That is a sort of an element of shamanism. But also, you know, as one of the things that I do I mentioned that I get out into the wilderness a lot. One of the things I do is a fly fish. And as a fly fisherman, you're trying to create the illusion of an insect that a trout would be feeding on. But the trout really constructs that image. You just give them a couple fibers that sort of glint a certain way on the water, and the trout constructs this image of this insect. So, and I think that we as humans do that too. I know that I have. Sometimes you just see what you really want to see or what you really fear to see.
And at one point in this book, that materializes as Squamiset sort of transforming himself into a satanic figure and scaring everybody off. But I guess he's just, you know, the equivalent of putting out a very realistic looking piece of bait.
Well, there's another part to that, and that is that, you know, if you read about English society at the time, you know, they were very rooted in the visionary and the unseen too. There were sailors that were seeing mermaids and sea serpents coiled on a rock outside of Cape Ann, you know, so that it was a part of daily life. They actually believed, the Puritans believed, that the devil was at large in the forest, and they feared it greatly. And so, it really, you know, for them to see a devil was, I think of it as something that wasn't too hard for Squamiset to do, because they were ready for it.
In ways that we aren't now, it seems.
That's right. That's right.
The book details some pretty graphic scenes of violence and punishment. You paint the English colonists as the evil people here. I mean, why do you think the colonists were a clear antagonist from Will's perspective?
You know, the English, and I have to say this as someone who's descended largely from Englishmen, they came to America because they wanted purity. They wanted to escape what they saw as the religious pollution that they were experiencing in Europe. And so when they got to New England, they saw these Indians as devil worshipers. They were, you know, it was a way that these Indians had a form of religion that was impure. And so the reaction, it was very extreme. In 1637, there was the incident of the Pequot Massacre, where a group of Englishmen and Indian allies surrounded a walled village and burned it to the ground, killing 600 to 700 people and selling the survivors into slavery. And so this was a reflection of the period, that this combination of thinking that Indians were devil worshippers, and also, you know, coincidentally, that the English needed more land because they had a lot of people coming in who were looking for land, led to some real antagonism between the forces. So I feel like that the book, in a way, is sort of just reflecting the reality.
What do you think of Thanksgiving as a holiday? The pop culture image of the holiday makes us think that there was at least one day of harmony. Does that ring true to you, given all you've researched?
Well, you know, it's what I would call the Thanksgiving myth. And, you know, in 1621, there was indeed a meal between the Wampanoags and the Pilgrims or Puritans. But it's what I call the Thanksgiving myth. And I think it does ring true as far as it goes, but it doesn't go far enough. I think that it's a much more complicated and interesting story because most Americans, if you ask them, they'll say, well, there's Thanksgiving, you know, we learned to plant corn, we had this meal, the Pilgrims survived, jump cut to 1776. And there's 150 years in there, and there's a lot that happened. I mean, there's these virgin soil epidemics that swept through New England between 1616 and 1619 and wiped out 95% of the population. There were, you know, several wars between the English and the Indians. There's a lot of very interesting history, and I think we need to be more honest with ourselves about our deepest national origins, because I think in the process of retelling ourselves these stories and sort of redefining the Thanksgiving myth and making it more real and more complicated, we're making ourselves better people. We're making ourselves better Americans, and we can go forward in a way that is more is more realistic, and it's, you know, can lead to greater healing. So I love Thanksgiving as a holiday, and I don't want to get rid of it or anything like that. I just think it's an opportunity for us to become more acquainted with 17th century history as it really was.
Your book certainly does that. So, Tim, thank you very much for speaking with us.
Peter, it's been a great pleasure.
That's Vermont writer Tim Weed talking with VPR's Peter Biello. Weed's new novel is called Will Poole's Island. We've talked a little about food and a little about history so far in today's show. Next up, another Thanksgiving tradition, driving long distances and the search for a cheap gallon of gas. This is Vermont Edition. Welcome back to Vermont Edition. I'm Jane Lindholm. As you're listening right now, you might be in the car and you might also be on a long drive to visit family or friends for the holiday. You are not alone. Americans traditionally drive long distances for the Thanksgiving holiday, and they'll spend at least part of that driving time scouting out prices for a gallon of gas. I talked with Pat Moody, manager of public affairs for AAA of Northern New England, and asked him to compare national gas prices to what drivers are seeing in our region.
Currently, the national average for self-serve regular is $2.84. That is the lowest we've seen since 2010 for the Thanksgiving holiday period. And it's going to be a welcome sight as 46.3 million Americans will head out on a trip of 50 miles or more over the Thanksgiving holiday period.
And that number of people who are traveling, that's up?
Yeah, it's up about 4%, a little over 4% from last year, and it is the high water mark since 2007.
So pre-recession numbers we're talking here. Pat, how much do gas prices play a role in whether or not people decide to travel?
You know, when we talk about holiday travel, particularly Thanksgiving, about 90% of those people heading out on their travel vacation or travel holiday are going by automobile. So typically, it doesn't necessarily impact whether they go or not. It just opens up their budget a little bit more for those things that they do while they're on their trip, so dining or shopping. So it does give them a little bit more flexibility to do other things while they're traveling.
So maybe they're having the turducken instead of the regular turkey.
Yeah, maybe they have a few extra dollars to buy a bigger turkey and have a larger feast.
So when we look at these prices, $2.84, the national average, and travelers really probably overjoyed to see gas prices under $3, but not if you're in Vermont. Most of the gas pumps in Vermont are above $3. Do you have any sense of why?
Yeah, interestingly enough, back on November 1st, we saw the national average drop below $3 a gallon for self-serve regular, and we're still paying over $3 a gallon in Vermont. The average statewide average for Vermont is about $3.08, $3.09. We've seen this in the past where it's less responsive when gas prices fall. The state of Vermont has got a smaller population, not as much volumes of fuel going through there, and just really not as much competition to drive that price lower.
The state average in Vermont is 8 cents or so, 8 or 9 cents over $3. What about the rest of New England? How do we compare?
Well, right now Vermont is the second highest statewide average for self-serve regular in New England, with Connecticut being the highest. Connecticut is around $3.15, $3.16 right now, where Vermont is $3.09, $3.08.
So where do I have to go to get it cheaper in New England?
The cheapest gas currently in New England can be found in the state of New Hampshire. And a big part of that is state taxes for gasoline.
Explain how that works. I know state taxes play a large role in what the price is from state to state. How does that typically break down in state averages?
No, there's a number of factors that go into the price of gasoline. One of the things that you can do is take a look at the pump the next time you're sitting there filling up, and it can talk to you a little bit about the different components of gasoline, you know, what it costs to refine, the crude oil price, the distribution, the markup at the pump, to, which is very small typically at the retail location, and then also the state and federal gas taxes that go into it. Every state has the same federal gas tax, but when it comes to the state gas tax, it differs per state.
Federal taxes, as I understand it right now, sit at about a little over 18 cents a gallon. And in Vermont, the total state taxes and fees are more than 32 cents. So when you look at the price you're paying per gallon right now in the state of Vermont, you're paying about 51 cents in just taxes and fees, state and federal taxes and fees. But the national average is a little bit lower than that, right, Pat? I think that's about 49 cents a gallon on average.
Yeah, right. The national average will be a little bit lower in the combination of state and federal when compared to the state of Vermont. And, you know, one of the things to also note is that the federal gas tax hasn't changed in 30 years now. The state of Vermont has done some things recently to try to boost those revenues for road repair. And they have changed a little bit in how they do tax the gasoline for the highway fund.
When I look at my price at the pump, which down the street here from my office, the price we're paying right now is about $3.12 or $3.15 a gallon. So if I think about, okay, well, Vermont has about 51 cents per gallon in state and federal taxes, is that what accounts for the fact that Vermont is higher than the national average? Or are there other factors that might not be quite so apparent, you know, our distance from refineries or something like
that? Oh, sure. Yeah. Yeah. It's definitely also the case of where you're getting your product from. On the East Coast right now, it's impacted by Europe. Supply is tight in Europe right now, and that means it's not as much imports into the East Coast, whereas if you were down in the Gulf Coast, there's more of an ample supply there. So, you know, it does. It definitely depends on where you're getting your supply, what the taxes are, what the transportation costs are, and then other overhead costs in terms of the retail locations in which the gas is being sold at. As far as things that some states have done, one is the broadening of the tax base. And this approach addresses the problem of declining tax revenues, gas tax revenues. And in Vermont's case, the intent of the change a couple of years ago was to stabilize the revenues by having a portion of the revenue become price sensitive. So as the price goes up, you can still maintain a little bit of revenues to put towards building the roads and bridges.
And then, Pat, you mentioned competition also plays a role. And in Vermont, the fact that we have a small population, you think just means for less competition?
Yeah, competition, in addition to those other things, comes into play. When you don't have as many stations and more of the smaller mom-and-pop gas stations, there's not as much competition to drive the prices down as quick as some of the other larger states that has a little bit more competition.
Is AAA predicting anything for the coming year in terms of gas prices?
There's going to be an OPEC meeting in December. That's probably going to be the next barometer to tell us what direction fuel is going in. Typically, what we see as we head into the new year, in January or February, those months are typically the months of the least amount of demand. So if everything holds true and there's no major disruption, we shouldn't see too much in terms of changes.
Pat Moody, thanks very much for talking with us.
Hey, great to be on here.
That's Pat Moody with AAA of Northern New England. So, listeners, we are curious what gas prices you're seeing around the state or just across the border. Tell us the best or worst prices for gas you have found and how far you're willing to go to fill up at a cheaper price. We are on Twitter at Vermont Edition, or you can friend us on Facebook. We're interested to see which corners of Vermont have the highest and lowest prices per gallon. We've heard for years that Vermont-grown food products have a certain cachet. And with Thanksgiving in sight, we're also reminded of how turkeys are getting from farm to table in our region. Well, that modern conversation is significantly different than it was nearly 200 years ago, when Vermont farmers took their turkeys to market in Boston by walking them there from Vermont. Last year at this time, we spoke with Peter Gilbert, chair of the Vermont Humanities Council, about this unique piece of Vermont farm history. Here's Gilbert explaining the annual turkey drives.
Well, we're talking about thousands in each trip. It depends on the year. Some were 7,000 up to 10,000. About 1,000 was the smallest number that made such a long trip worthwhile to pay for the expenses.
What were the expenses?
Well, you had to have drovers along with you to urge the turkeys along the way, to throw cracked corn in front of them so they would walk forward. You had to have people riding in the wagons to carry the supplies, the corn and supplies for the people who went along the way, women, men. It was a large enterprise.
And this was really well-suited to child labor?
It would be part of any farm families always had farm children involved in the work of the farm.
And these were several different farms that would come together to do a communal drive, right? I mean, it's not 7,000 turkeys on one farm like you might see in some states today.
That's right. One of the largest drives in the fall of 1824 involved 40 homesteads. Other times, a person would come by in advance, purchase turkeys from different farmers, and on the appointed day would walk by, pick up the turkeys, then head south.
I rush to say that you were not alive for these turkey drives in the early 1800s. Nonetheless, can you paint a picture for us of what it might have looked like to have thousands of turkeys walking to Boston? Were they actually on roads?
Well, sometimes they were on roads, but remember, in 1824, the roads were not very good. Sometimes they were just paths. Sometimes they made their way across fields. They did have wagons along the way, but this was a primitive and challenging trip that far. They went all the way from northern Vermont, from the Canadian border, from Highgate, from Island Pond. So you had large groups of people urging these turkeys along, kids throwing food in front of them to get them to walk forward. They would ebb and flow. Sometimes it'd be just a couple feet wide, but sometimes 50 yards wide in the chaos of travel. The problem with turkeys is they stop walking when they think it's dusk, and there's nothing you can do about it. Wherever they are when the sun sets, that's where they perch for the night, and their collective weight shatters trees. Occasionally, birds end up perching on a farmer's shed or barn, and the building collapses. In fact, in one town, they roosted on top of the school building, and the school collapsed. That was in Burke. They went through covered bridges, and sometimes when they'd go through the covered bridge, they would mistake the shade of the bridge for dusk and simply stop. And so the drovers would have to go in there and pick them up and carry them through the bridge into the sun, where they'd perk up again. There's a record in southern Vermont reporting how they clogged a covered bridge for 2 days, how they stopped in the middle of the road on two dark gray November days in the middle of the road and stopped traffic there. He was a guy from western Massachusetts named Father John O'Sheehan. And in 1840, he records that he bumped into a large flocks of Vermont turkeys. He was headed north in his Surrey towards Brattleboro, and he met a turkey drive headed south. The turkeys began to roost on his Surrey and on the backs of his horses, and so he had to drive for dear life, apparently, to get out of there. But he still ended up with a good coating of turkey guano all over himself and his Surrey and his horses.
It sounds like a prelude to a Hitchcock movie.
It is indeed. I think of it more as irony or comic. You know, it stands in delightful contrast to the celebrated heroic cattle drives from the American West. And here in the East, we have turkey drives. It's just a
yes.
Wonderful a contrast.
This must have been somewhat hard on the turkeys, though. I mean, we are talking about anywhere from 150 to 350 miles of walking in what, I think 10 days or a couple of weeks?
Well, they could only go 10 to 12 miles a day. And so it was a big process. They lost a lot of turkeys on the way. Maybe 10% of them were drowned in river crossings, taken by foxes, died of natural causes there. And one of the natural causes would be farmers' families. As they walked by the farm, they just might, a couple of them might lose their way into the pot in that farm family's kitchen. And remember, it's November. It's a sketchy time in Vermont. Sometimes they dipped the turkey's feet in warm tar. It didn't hurt, apparently, but it protected the turkey's feet from the frozen ground, from the rough terrain. Maybe it gave them even better traction on icy days. I don't know.
This, to me, I mean, if it happened today, I think we'd all be out to see the big turkey drive because it would be such an unusual sight and somewhat amusing and maybe alarming. Maybe we'd just want to make sure we kept them off our barns and garages. But was this something that people looked forward to seeing in the 1800s, or was this such a part of normal life that it didn't really raise any eyebrows?
Well, because it was just an annual autumnal event, I think it was something of a special occasion. You have traffic through small towns very rarely, and this must have been kind of an exciting enterprise to be part of, an exciting parade, as it were, going through your little town. But it was apparently fairly common in around Vermont. They went from many different communities, and it was part of normal life. They were only annual because in those days, turkeys were not eaten throughout the year. They were mainly eaten for Thanksgiving and Christmas dinner. And that's why, the principal reason why they went down towards Boston in the fall.
Why did the turkey drives end?
Mostly because of the coming of railroads to Vermont in the 1850s. First, just plain old railroad cars, but then refrigerated box cars. Also, adding to their demise was the rise of steamboat traffic on Lake Champlain. But nevertheless, they continued through the 19th century and some into the early part of the 20th century.
Peter Gilbert is chair of the Vermont Humanities Council. We asked him to tell us the story of Vermont's annual turkey drives to Boston in the 1800s. And now we open our virtual mailbag to read some of your comments about Vermont Edition. Managing producer Patty Daniels joins me. Hi, Patty.
Hi, Jane. So we've interviewed both of Vermont's U.S. senators in the last week, Patrick Leahy and Bernie Sanders, and we have several notes from you in reaction to those programs.
We'll start with Friday's interview with Senator Leahy. Leahy explained why he supports President Obama's recent decision on immigration, and that prompted this comment from John. John says, "I think it's outrageous when I hear that the government doesn't want to enforce the law because it's not practical to deport 11 million illegal aliens. The government's refusal to enforce the law is what caused the problem in the first place, and now they justify their inaction and incompetence by saying it's too hard for them to do it."
Well, we also talked about the results of midterm elections, and to that point, Mark posted this comment. "Is Senator Leahy going to say something to us today that he hasn't already said 50,000 times on numerous other news outlets already? Yes, we know Republicans in Washington are behaving like hypocrites. Yes, we know President Obama has taken some controversial steps toward immigration reform. Yes, we know there's a country full of immigrants who can, do, and have contributed lots to our society. Yada, yada, yada," says Mark. "I wish on this hometown news program that Senator Leahy would speak to us as people, not voters."
Okay, on Monday, it was Senator Sanders' turn in the hot seat. Sanders repeated his opposition to the Keystone XL crude oil pipeline. But when a listener asked his position on the natural gas pipeline in Addison County, here was his answer.
"Well, it's, you know, I voted on the Keystone pipeline, and that's an issue that I have been heavily involved in. To a large degree, the issue of the pipeline going through Addison County is a state issue. I think the debate is a difficult debate."
Well, some of you felt Sanders was equivocating. Winston replied with this comment online. "I wish that Senator Sanders had stated a position on the Addison County natural gas pipeline rather than punting."
And while we spent most of the hour talking about issues, we also asked, will he or won't he run for president? Vinny in Stratford, Connecticut, wasn't the only listener who joined from out of state to comment on that topic. Vinny wrote, "I believe there is the appetite for Bernie's ideas in this country. A lot of people are looking for a progressive alternative to Hillary Clinton, and I believe Bernie is that person."
And Kerber posted online, "Senator Sanders, if you run, I will quit my job and commit myself 100% to the effort. Our nation is in big trouble. This is the fight. Nothing else matters if we can't get control and restore democracy."
But Charlie is less of a fan. He wrote in response to our two interviews with Senator Sanders and Senator Leahy, "I want to know when they're both going to retire."
Well, we always welcome your comments and reaction to what you hear. You can find us on Twitter at Vermont Edition or friend us on Facebook.
Or send an email to vermontedition@vpr.net. Thanks, Patty.
You're welcome.
And that'll do it for today. Vermont Edition is taking a short break for the Thanksgiving holiday, but we'll be back on Monday with live programs that explore the news and culture that define Vermont and our region. Vermont Edition is produced by Patty Daniels, Rick Singeri, and Sage Van Wing. Our executive producer is John Van Hoosen, and our theme music was composed by Grace Potter and the Nocturnals. I'm Jane Lindholm. Have a happy Thanksgiving.